Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's February 10th. Currently, we've got 8 degrees under blue skies here in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 12 degrees under mostly sunny skies. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, we are waking up to some frigid temperatures out there. We've got those numbers, as you mentioned, down into the single digits and low teens. Now, the good news is we are expecting sunshine as we go throughout the day, and the winds will remain fairly light. So we're not going to be talking about a big wind chill for us today as high temperatures climb to about the low to mid 30s there in the Heber Valley. But it's going to be a struggle to get back to 30 degrees around Park City. So it is definitely going to be a cold day, but don't worry. If you think it's cold today, we've got colder weather heading our way as we go into the next couple of days. So that's something to look forward to. In fact, as we go throughout tonight, we'll head back down into the digits and low teens for overnight lows. We'll see clouds on the increase as we go throughout tonight. And then as we go throughout your Tuesday, not only will it be a colder day with highs only around 30 for the Heber Valley and highs only in the mid-20s for Park City, but we're going to introduce a chance of scattered snow showers by Tuesday, midday into the afternoon hours. Now, this is not looking like a major event. We're probably talking a dusting to an inch in some of the mountains, but it's not going to be a big accumulating event, but it's going to be a sign of some much colder weather moving in. In fact, those northwesterly winds are going to really start to pick up by Tuesday afternoon into Tuesday evening, and that means the wind chills will likely drop down into the single digits and teens as early as Tuesday evening. Now, as we get into your Wednesday, we're looking at partly cloudy skies. It will look pretty nice outside, but it is not going to feel nice out there. In fact, Wednesday morning, overnight low temperatures both in the Heber Valley and Park City will likely be around zero, if not a degree or two below zero as we kick off the day for your Wednesday. High temperatures on Wednesday, we're going to be struggling to hit 20 degrees in Park City for a high on Wednesday, with highs only in the mid to upper 20s for the Heber Valley. So definitely staying below freezing as we go throughout the entire day on your Wednesday across the area, and most likely on your Tuesday and Wednesday staying below freezing. Now, as we head into your Thursday morning, we've got more changes heading your way. It's going to be another very frigid start with temperatures back down into the single digits. We're talking probably between 0 and 5 degrees for both Park City and the Heber Valley. But here's the thing, we're going to have clouds on the increase throughout the day. The winds will switch out of the south and become breezy, so we'll have that. But we'll also see those temperatures climbing back close to freezing. But don't let that fool you, because we are expecting a juicy atmospheric river to move into the area for your Thursday. And that's going to mean by Thursday afternoon and Thursday evening, snow will be breaking out across Park City and the Heber Valley. And we're talking about accumulating snow likely for most of the Wasatch back as we go into your Thursday night, heading into Friday, and your Friday heading into Saturday. So we've got kind of a long duration winter storm event potentially for the end of the week. So let's enjoy the nice weather that we have out there for us today.
Okay, thank you, Cedric. And taking a look in the backcountry, we've got Drew with the Utah Avalanche Center looking for, looks like we got like a nice rainbow flake showing up here, Drew.
Boy, it's been a bad year avalanche-wise, Leslie. It's, I mean, with Saturday's avalanche fatality in Silver Fork of Picudwood Canyon, is actually a friend of mine. He's 59-year-old male, lives in Salt Lake. And then a week ago today, a snowmobiler from Evanston, 37-year-old male, killed in the Monte Cristo area. That's just east of Huntsville, up what we call the Ogden area mountains. And then two more fatalities over the holidays. It's just been a bad scene, Leslie. And even with this, particularly because the storm on Friday, it was over producer. I mean, all the models expected maybe a foot of snow, and it was 1 to 2 feet of snow, heavy, dense snow, lots of grapple, lots of wind. Snowpacks, it's really variable and structured, it's not stable. And I think it'll continue to be dangerous in some areas today. It's really complicated out there, Leslie. I just want your listeners to know it's a complicated snowpack out there with a lot of things going on, a lot of weak layers. To me, over 25 years forecasting, the name of the game to me is when things get very complicated, make it simple. And that simple choice is choosing low-angle terrain, 30 degrees and less. Skiing and riding's awesome out there on low-angle terrain. And just let things settle out for the next few days. We'll be trending towards moderate. But again, we got another storm on tap for late Thursday, Friday. We'll see how things play out.
Well, I'm sorry about the loss of your buddy. And I'm going to say, if it's a friend of yours, I'm assuming he knew what he was in for, yeah?
I got to tell you, Leslie, I mean, the truth of the matter is, at the end of the day, nature, Mother Nature has the final say, has the upper hand. And many of us have been, had our close calls and scrapes, and some of us have just been luckier than others. It's just important to keep those lessons close at home, you know, when you're heading to the mountains.
At this point, your report doesn't show the slope of the angle. So are we saying above 30, though, degrees?
You mean for the fatality?
Yeah.
Dave Kelly, another forecaster, and I were up there yesterday to go try to investigate this avalanche. It is steep terrain, probably getting towards 40 degrees in steepness. It's west-facing aspect, roughly starting zone, roughly 10,200 feet, 10,300 feet. I suspect it ran on faceted snow that was, because it ran over the holidays. There was a large avalanche in that terrain over the holidays, and it's just reloaded and it was triggered again on Saturday. But honestly, Leslie, there was too much hang fire, too much lingering avalanche prone snow surrounding that avalanche, and so we were not going to stick our necks out to go take a look at the layering in there, and so we can make a best guess estimate, and we'll have a report out in the coming days.
Okay, and when it does show a depth of just 2 feet, it's still, when it runs that far, snow's adding up quickly.
Well, it is. Yeah. I mean, it ran a long ways. You know, he was killed by trauma, there's just no way around it. You've just got to be mindful that avalanches are pose a significant threat, natural hazard in the backcountry in the mountains, and we just want people to stay safe. We have areas of considerable danger out there. It's when most of our accidents occur, we just want people to stay safe and come home to their families at the end of the day.
Okay. Drew, thank you.
Thank you.
And again, strict travel protocols essential for any backcountry riding today. You can always check out the forecast by going online to utahavalanchecenter.org. Well, stay tuned. Coming up, we'll be checking in with, again, Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant with an update. Youth Sports Alliance Executive Director Emily Fisher will be joined by Programs Director Heather Sims. And then finally, the Executive Director of the Christian Center of Park City, Steve Richardson, joining us. We're taking a look at some local news now. This summer, visitors will now have to pay to park at Bloods Lake and several other popular Park City trailheads in Bonanza Flat. KPCW's Park Amella Tester reports that parking, however, will remain free for city residents.
The Park City Council approved a new management plan for Bonanza Flat Thursday. It's grown in popularity in recent years for its scenic beauty and high-altitude trails. Park City Trails and Open Space Coordinator Billy Curick told the council that parking enforcement wrote more than 100 tickets on peak leaf-peeping days during fall 2024.
And we also continue to deal with vandalism and trespass issues. While we're off chasing down cars in the roadway, we see cut locks, fences moved, motorized use violations, and other trespass issues in the property that impact wildlife and user experience.
Parking in a Bonanza Flat no parking zone will cost offenders $200. Illegally parking in an ADA spot carries a $300 fine. Bonanza Flat user data collected over the summer of 2023 found Park City residents account for 7% of the visitors. Salt Lake City locals made up the largest portion at 25%. The data also shows most visitors stay in Bonanza Flat for less than 45 minutes. The new plan, approved by the council, aims to better manage that congestion through paid parking and enhance public transit to Bonanza Flat. Starting this summer, paid parking kiosks will charge hourly rates at the Bloods Lake, Bonanza Flat, and Empire Pass trailheads. The initial price proposal is $5 per hour. However, the city plans to use dynamic pricing, where parking rates increase at peak times. Parking will be free for residents in the 84060 zip code who register their license plates with the city. Park City voters approved a $48 million bond in 2017 to purchase Bonanza Flat and protect it from development. A golf course and hundreds of ski-in, ski-out condos were once proposed for the property, nestled between Upper Deer Valley, Brighton, and Wasatch Mountain State Park. Keurig, the trails coordinator for Park City, also said the U.S. Forest Service is beginning to roll out paid parking at trailheads in nearby Big Cottonwood Canyon, which could potentially leave Bonanza Flat exposed to a flood of traffic if parking fees aren't implemented. Along with paid parking, the city plans to expand public transit to Bonanza Flat. From July 3rd to October 30th, Park City Transit's Purple Bus would service the area's trailheads. The shuttle will run Friday to Monday from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. every 15 minutes. The Purple Bus normally travels between Old Town and the Montage Hotel. The proposed move is seen as an enhancement to the existing Transit to Trails program that provides free rides to Bonanza Flat. City officials said revenue from the new paid parking will fund the enhanced transit service. Park City also plans to construct a new trailhead with 15 paid parking stalls, including ADA access at the Y intersection of Guardsman Pass Road and Pine Canyon Drive. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Health Department, I have Director Phil Bondurant. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with bird flu. Any idea of the impact that it's had on us here in Summit County other than the price of eggs?
Yeah, that's the common theme is the price of eggs, and we're seeing a lot of that in the national media. But here locally in Summit County, we're continuing to monitor it. Most of the monitoring is done by the state health department and the Department of Agriculture, and we're not immune to the presence of bird flu, whether it's in our wild bird populations or in our domestic, even our backyard chicken flocks. There's no immunity to it per se. With our birds in migratory season right now, there's a story on KSL this morning that they estimate there's 15,000 to 25,000 grebes that have died from bird flu that are just littered all over the Great Salt Lake. And I think with that migratory pattern, birds coming in from different areas, and then what we know is occurring both in cattle and in our chickens, Summit County is no different. We have not had any human cases of bird flu transmission from birds or cattle to humans in the state of Utah, but the network that monitors that is operating at full speed right now and making sure that we keep tabs on that.
Yeah, so what is bird flu?
It's an avian influenza. It has transitioned quite a few different times. Now there's so many variants that they're no longer referring to it as H5N1, but just simply H5. And there's two or three dominant strains right now that are circulating in the United States and globally that create a flu in birds. And it is generally 100% lethal. There's a high mortality rate among those populations that get it. Cattle seem to have a different outcome with it. Some of them do perish. Others are able to recover from it. But it's one of those zoonotic diseases that finds its way into the animals that we associate with on a regular basis and then has the potential to transition into human and make us sick.
So any correlation, though, with our COVID virus being transmitted to the bird population, and that's where they're getting this from?
No, this is more of a naturally occurring avian influenza that through its different viral transitions and different viral makeups has found a way to use humans as a host, where traditionally that hasn't been the path or the course of its staying relevant. So COVID, we did see during the COVID pandemic, there was a bit of diseases being transitioned over to dogs and other animals, but this is a completely separate item. It's just one of those seasonal diseases that we now get to deal with, but it's the concern is that it has found a way to hop over from animals to humans.
So you say no human transmission at this point. I mean, how would you know whether or not you have avian flu?
Yeah, there's a lot of work that's being done inside of our the poultry industry and the cattle industry for those farmers that are, or those workers that are inside that agriculture industry on symptoms and the testing that can be done if individuals are feeling some of those symptoms. And it's typical flu-like symptoms, tired, worn out, chest congestion, headaches, muscle fatigue, muscle soreness. So if you are working in that industry, it's definitely something that is at the top of their concern list right now, and keeping those workers healthy. And we've done everything we can to support our state agencies that are leading the charge on this with our local workers.
All right. And as you mentioned, we are hearing that it is being spread to cattle. I mean, what does that mean? That you don't eat beef, or, I mean...
Yeah, that's the number one question we're actually receiving, or that I have received at the health department, is number one is, if you can afford eggs, are they okay to eat? Is the chicken that we okay to eat? If we have chickens in our backyard, is it okay to eat? And then, of course, the question you just asked around beef, and that's the importance of cooking food thoroughly, making sure that when you have eggs, you know, you're cooking them to 165 degrees, same with chicken. That temperature will kill any of the avian influenza viruses that are present inside of the meat or inside of the egg. Now, cattle, I haven't seen anything where the beef is infected, but anytime you have a meat, you know, you should really take into consideration what that cooking temperature should be where you like to eat that meat, and then the risks associated with eating rare or raw meat.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, people who may have their own chickens either to eat or to eat the eggs, what do they need to do to ensure that their hens are safe?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is just being aware, right? If you, these individuals that have backyard flocks, they know how their animals behave. They know if something is not right or that they're a little bit off, and then just taking proper precautions. It is transmitted through the air, so it can be a respiratory disease. It also can be based on the fluids that come from the animal. So if you get it on your hands and then touch your eyes or somewhere that it can enter your body. So we are just advising individuals to use gloves. If you have sick chickens that you're disposing of, maybe some respiratory protection, a mask or something like that, just to limit that transmission effect. We've also spoken to a few waterfowl hunters or duck hunters, given that some of the ducks have been found positive with avian influenza, and what they can do. And it's the same idea. Make sure that when you consume the meat that it's cooked thoroughly, that you're taking precautions when you're cleaning that animal, and washing your hands thoroughly when you're done.
And I think there's also a lot of concern because we're hearing more and more as it kind of comes out with the federal funding being cut for health research. Should we be concerned? I mean, in terms of future viruses? I mean, if we don't have the money to do the research, are we putting ourselves in jeopardy here?
Yeah, I think anytime there's a conversation about reduction in funding that would limit or put a pause on any of the research that's being done around diseases, disease transmission, programming related to federal funding, there's a moment or a concern there. We're monitoring that situation closely, not only from the disease research perspective, but also just in local programming, understanding what some of the federal funding or the uncertainty around that federal funding is going to mean for local public health in the coming years.
Yeah, at this point, you don't really know much?
I think some of the things that are being shared at the federal level create that uncertainty, which is a bit alarming, but it's also makes us uneasy. But we did have an opportunity last week to meet with Congressman Blake Moore's staff around local public health departments and the challenges that we face. It was a great meeting, and one of the things that we learned is that Congressman Blake Moore is part of the government efficiency effort at the federal level, and they were really interested to hear ways that we can get the federal funding to the local health departments quicker and sooner rather than having it go through the different, what we refer to as filters, the federal level, federal agencies to the state level, through the state level agencies, and then down to the locals, where by the time it's gone through all those different filters and the parameters have been placed on that funding, it doesn't only reduce the funding, but it restricts the way that we can use the funding. And after meeting with Blake Moore's staff, we felt really comfortable and what they are trying to convey to us about how we can be more efficient in getting funding at the local level. Now, that's a completely different story than what we're hearing in the news about executive orders and some of the things that took place last week that really put some concern into the health department. So there's a lot of different conversations going on. Our funding cycles rotate every year. And what I mean by that is we know where our funding is going to be about mid-June, and it starts over July 1st. So we have a few months to learn and to be aware of what is coming our way. But in the health department, we have taken some proactive steps to prepare ourselves for that July 1st date and be prepared to remain flexible and innovative if we do see some cuts in our funding.
Yeah, so where do you think you would see those cuts? I mean, are we talking about the WIC, the Women and Children program, other public health programs, immunization?
Yeah, I think it's all on the table, unfortunately. A lot of the actions that have been taken have, there's not really any rhyme or reason to them. There's no, they're not using data to make those decisions. They're not looking at local level perspectives. And the concern is that we don't have a clear direction on what the qualifiers are or what the parameters are that they're using to determine where and when the funding should go. And that being said, all of our programs outside of the money allocated from the state legislature and from our local elected officials at the county is federal funding. And so when we see changes happen, it goes from the federal level to the state level, which is then it's allocated to us here at the local health department level. So we have these three different funding streams that we really have to keep an eye on and try to understand in a very short turnaround what it is we're going to have to do to keep these services going.
Yeah. Are you pulling back then at this point financially, just knowing that you're on a July 1 or you're on a calendar year, so this would, if any cuts were made, that would be halfway through your budget year.
Absolutely, yeah. And I know that in conversations with Shane Scott, our county manager, and certain council members, obviously that's a concern for all of us. We don't want our community to be short on those services that they depend on. But absolutely, we've sat down inside the health department and started looking at some strategies to, like you said, pull back, be a little bit more conservative, understanding that those monies that we anticipated coming from the state to us on July 1 may not be at the same level that we have seen in years past. I do believe that we will not see a complete cut of funding, but we should expect that there's going to be cuts in funding, much like we've seen with all new presidential administrations. There's always some changes and modifications that are made in those funding streams, and we anticipate that. This year is just a little bit more concerning for us because where in years past we've seen clear direction coming from our federal partners, this year even our federal partners are at a bit of a loss as to what the funding looks like in the future.
So who is eligible for Summit County Health Department food, immunization, WIC programs? I mean, does anybody have to show legal resident paperwork in order to receive those?
We do not require for our services an individual to disclose their residency status. Now, there are a few programs where part of the application there is a residency status box that you can check, but that's by personal preference. It can be left blank. Our role inside of this community, regardless of an individual's status, is to make sure that everyone here is healthy. We will offer services to anyone that comes in that qualifies for vaccinations for children, vaccinations for adults, those that can pay, those that can't pay. We will do what we can to make sure services are made available. Now, I know, given the political climate around immigration and some of these more politically charged topics, that level of trust can be challenging, being that we are a government agency. But I can assure those that are listening that the Summit County Health Department is committed to providing services for all residents of Summit County. And while it may not seem that way, the Summit County Health Department is a safe space. We do appreciate those individuals that are willing to come and partake in our services, and we'll do what we can to keep this community as healthy as possible.
Okay, we often talk about this time of year about the cold and the norovirus and the COVID numbers, but let's talk a little bit about mental wellness. What are you seeing there? I mean, I can just barely start to see the change in sunlight in the mornings, which is always a good welcome relief. What are you seeing?
Yeah, we often talk about cold, flu. This year we get to add norovirus to that conversation. And our physical health is an easy one. It's commonplace to visit the doctor, to visit the quick care, and receive treatment from a primary care or from a qualified physician. But we still are in a space where we're not perceiving our mental health to be the same way as our physical health. They're both closely connected. They both affect one another. And I think once we get into this deep winter, and people are on the verge of spring, kind of waiting for spring to get here, we can see that it becomes a challenge for our mental health. You know, it may seem a bit silly, but you throw in Valentine's Day, and that can also be challenging to our mental health. And so it's just an important reminder for those that are listening that it's okay to feel a little down. It's okay to feel as though you're just not yourself. But what's not okay is to feel like you should be embarrassed for those feelings, that you're not seeking mental health help from a qualified individual. And if you're in a space where you don't have insurance or you don't have the means to receive that care, the Summit County Health Department through our Behavioral Health Division can help. We have a strong contract that we've just completed with the University of Utah. Our county council has committed resources to this because they, like I do, see the value in a healthy community, not just physically, but mentally as well. And we don't want anybody to feel just lost because they don't have resources or they don't know how to manage their feelings. They don't know what these feelings are. And this is just a gentle and friendly reminder that those feelings are okay, but let's make sure we're talking to people that know how to help. Let's get you the resources you need. And you can always call the health department at 435-333-1500. We're happy to get you in touch with the right people that can get you in a place where, regardless of your situation, we can get you speaking to somebody, talking to somebody, and get you on that path to feeling good and being good.
Okay. It's February. That means it's American Heart Month. What do you want people to know about that?
Yeah, I still am blown away that even with Utah being one of the top five healthiest states in the nation overall, we still see a significant number of deaths related to heart disease. It's the number one cause of death in the state of Utah, even ahead of cancer and accidental deaths. You think about how much driving we do, how much skiing we do, those outdoor activities, yet heart disease beats all of them in the cause of death. And so what I would want individuals to know is that we can't take our health for granted. I think everybody knows that, but that includes our heart. It starts early in our, as adults, in our physical activity, our eating habits, our check-ins, our checkups. Just make sure that you're keeping that at the forefront of your mind. You know, nationally, someone dies from heart disease every 33 seconds. That is pretty remarkable, especially in a country like the United States. So the state health department has a helpline. That number is 888-222-2542. And what that line is intended to do is provide individuals with resources, but also connect them with local professionals that understand cardiovascular health and get them some resources to get them on that path to a good, healthy heart that gives us a long and healthy life.
All right. And finally, just any legislative updates related to public health that you're keeping your eye on?
Yeah, there's always those legislative updates, but three that are really big is Senate Bill 172, which is the opportunity we had to work with Senator Sandall on Title 19 changes, which allows us to improve our relationship with our partners at the State Department of Environmental Quality. So that's a positive one. Another one is House Bill 294. That's working with Representative McPherson on orders of constraint versus isolation and quarantine. Words that we hope we never have to use again, but that were at the tip of our tongue during the pandemic and trying to clean up some of that language and the authorities granted to local public health authorities. And then I think the big one that we're going to see really ramp up here in the next couple of weeks is House Bill 432. And that's some cleanup language and an effort in response to Senate Bill 61 from last legislative session around e-cigarettes and vaping products, and trying to do the best we can to protect our youth from accessing those products ahead of turning 21 and really empowering local health departments to promote the safe handling of those products for our youth in preventing that access. So really a couple big bills that we're working on with our legislators. They're positive interactions to this point, and we appreciate their efforts to help support public health.
Okay, Phil, I'm going to leave it there. See you next month.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Joining me now in studio with a Youth Athlete Report, Executive Director of Youth Sports Alliance, Emily Fisher, along with Programs Director Heather Sims. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Emily, let's start with you. Again, we've got some alum that are just kind of, yay, doing
yeah,
well.
Yeah, so exciting now that we've been around for a minute. It's so awesome to see all of our alumni just doing amazing things on the world stage. And not to sound like a broken record, but Lauren Masuga, she finished third bronze medal at the Super G and her very first world championships this past week. She's a Get Out and Play alumni of the Youth Sports Alliance. She participated in our Alpine Learn to Ski and also our Alpine Learn to Ski Jump. So just awesome just to see her in her first world championships on the podium. Awesome. Other highlights, homegrown athletes, Josie Johnson. She's a Get Out and Play alumni in ski jumping. She finished fifth in a mixed team event at the Ski Jumping World Cup held in Lake Placid over the weekend. She also had a personal best finish of 24th in the event. Charlie Mickle and Nick Page, both Wasatch Freestyle alumni, finished fifth and sixth at the Mogul World Cup in Deer Valley. And then another Masuga, Ali Masuga, Park City Ski and Snowboard alumni, Get Out and Play alumni, finished eighth in the Moguls. Casey Hogg, who's a Wasatch Freestyle alumni, finished ninth. And then in the aerials, Connor Curran, who received funding from YSA, finished fourth. And Tazia Tanner finished sixth. And then our last, Ashley Farquharson, who's our Get Out and Play alumni, and Stein Erickson Endowment recipient, finished sixth in a Women's Luge World Cup. So, World Championships. So just really neat to see across all sports, all disciplines, success from our alumni.
Okay. So we're about at that time when Youth Sports Alliance starts issuing what you call post-season scholarships. Emily, what are these?
Correct. So the Stein Erickson Endowment, we give out scholarship funding twice a year. In the fall, it is for your annual estimated cost of your year. And this is all need-based scholarships. So it's based on your family funding. And if you don't have the ability to participate, we offer scholarships. And then in the springtime, so now we do two sessions, the A session and the B session. It is for need-based assistance for postseason competition. So if you're having a great season and you qualified for U.S. Nationals, Junior World, something like that, that wasn't in the program and you can't afford that, you can apply for funding. So that is for our partner clubs, which is Figure Skating Club of Park City, Park City Ice Miners, Park City Ski and Snowboard, Park City Speed Skating Club, Wasatch Freestyle Foundation, and Wasatch Luge Club, and Utah Olympic Park Bobsled and Skeleton. So there's two application periods now until February 17th, and these awards will be announced February 28th. And then application B period is March 17th to April 4th. And these awards will be announced by April 11th. So all of that information is at ysausa.org.
Okay. And for somebody thinking that they might want to apply for this, what is it that they need to show?
So because these are awards are bigger awards, they need to fill out the application, and it does include some financial family information, so some tax information just to look at, make sure that the funding is going to families the most in need. For our annual scholarships, about 50% of those scholarships goes to families that are on the free and reduced lunch program. So there are quite a few families out there that can't afford to participate without these scholarships. So want to make sure that anyone who has an athlete in those seven winter sport clubs can participate if they would like to.
Okay. How much money do you have to hand out?
Well, this year, very exciting. This year, we're going to give out $200,000 to athletes in those clubs. We've already given away about, we've already awarded about $150,000. So we have about $50,000 to go for students or athletes in those seven clubs who are participating in postseason competitions.
Okay, YSAUSA.org. Heather, you've got, YSA's got an upcoming discussion, part of this Power of Play presentation. Tell us about this.
Yes, over the last year, the Youth Sports Alliance have been moderating a quarterly presentation on topics aimed to improve the youth sports experience on the Wasatch Back. And this March, March 12th, 6 to 8 at the Blair Education Center, we'll hold a presentation followed by a discussion on athlete anxiety. In the past, we've done it mainly for coaches and administrators, but this one is actually for parents, coaches, administrators, and athletes from middle school through collegiate programs. And athletes and parents will learn techniques to manage pregame nerves, overcome fear of failure, and address perfectionism in sports. Also, parents will gain insights on how parents can effectively support and encourage resilience in their young athletes. The presentation is led by Dr. Michael Larson, a performance psychology expert, and Dr. Matthew Seeley, a biomechanics professor focused on positive youth sports experiences. Both are associated with Brigham Young University and the Strong Youth Project. It's a free event, and obviously in this town we have a lot of competitive sports with athletes who feel a lot of anxiety. So if you are interested, register at ysausa.org and click on the News and Events tab.
Okay, and then these two doctors, tell us, I mean, where did you find them?
So Dr. Matthew Seeley came to our last event and wanted to be involved in, you know, we're looking at topics that are really trying to expand the experience of athlete sports on the Wasatch Back. And we connected, and one of the topics that I was most interested in, having had competitive athletes, my kids are competitive athletes myself, is athlete anxiety. And so he was excited to be part of it and had a member of his team. And Intermountain are supporting us and actually doing the sponsorship for it. So, and it's a free event, and we just love to see as many athletes and parents and coaches attend.
Okay, what's the latest with your after-school programs?
Oh, wow. So this year has been a big year. we have had 2,183 students for our programs, with 22% of our participants receiving free and reduced lunch. Roughly half of our participants receive scholarships or discounts. We're able to provide discounts to school employees, first responders, and siblings, thanks to the generous sponsorship from Kodiak. Our main primary ski programs wrapped up on Friday, and I have to give a shout out to Park City Mountain and especially longtime employee Mike Sussman. When weather conspired against us with wind, rain, lightning, and holds this Friday, he moved lessons for more than 200 students on Friday, as well as their instructors, to Park City Mountain. And we are so grateful that they were able to help us end our Learn to Ski and Snow program on a high note. We're also thankful to Deer Valley and the Share Winter Program, Woodward Park City, Utah Olympic Park, and White Pine Touring for accommodating nearly 800 students in on-snow programs over the past month.
Okay, but you do have some new programs coming up?
We do. We have a bunch of programs that start later in February with openings for Wasatch, South Summit, North Summit school districts. We have ski jumping, breaking, breakdancing, theater, and more. And in March, there are still programs open for all our schools. We have water polo, we have a learn to speed skate, golf skills, we have cooking, we have art, and all programs can be found at ysausa.org.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
No, I just wanted to say a huge shout out to Heather Sims and her whole program staff. I mean, Friday was a bit apocalyptic with wind holds, lightning. I mean, you name it, we rolled up with seven big buses at Park City Mountain, and there was a lightning hold, and we couldn't take them off the buses, and they kept the kids entertained and made it happen for those kids to get out for that fifth ski lesson, and they all had a great time. It started snowing. So just huge shout out to the community and to Heather and her staff.
Okay. Emily Fisher, Heather Sims, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In the studio now, the executive director of the Christian Center of Park City, Steve Richardson. Good morning.
Good morning.
So 4 months into the new job, how's it going?
4 months into the new job, it's going great, but it's also a huge learning curve for me. I thought it would be so much easier transitioning to civilian life, to learning, just transitioning my caregiving. But I'll tell you, Park City has been surprising in so many ways, and most of them good. It is a lot more cold than I expected coming from Northern California, but we are absolutely loving the people here. The care that everybody seems to have for anybody in need is just absolutely amazing. The number of people that want to work together, the number of people that want to support each other, the different nonprofits that say, hey, I can do this, can you do this, I can take this part, can you do this part, has been phenomenal. And I've really just been so overwhelmed by how many people want to support and are just saying, tell me what you need. You know, if you need a volunteer for this or need a volunteer for that, we'd love to be able to use you or love to be able to help. And so it's been really wonderful for that.
Okay. Hey, I noted from your newsletter last month, Catalina Alvarado Lopez, this was the mom who was hit and killed crossing Kearns Boulevard.
Yes.
You said that she was afraid to use the underground walkway. I mean, why? And how do you know that?
So her daughter was the one that shared that with me. We met with her daughter along with the police department a couple of days after the event. And her daughter was talking about how much, obviously, she was in pain and how much she was hurt. And one of the police people said, well, we know there's a walkway underneath the overpass or underneath the road. And her daughter said, yes, I've talked to my mom about using that walkway more. And she was just nervous because it wasn't quite as lighted as where she felt comfortable with. Even during the day, she got that eerie feeling inside of her, is the way her daughter described it. And then the daughter said, you know, it's even been tough for me to use that underpass, that it's just a scary thing for a lot of people. If you're by yourself, if you're feeling vulnerable and you're walking down a long hallway that is lit but not incredibly lit, it didn't feel safe to her.
So any changes that we need to make to that?
It's possible. You know, I think everything, we always need to consider not just whether or not somebody can see their foot in front of them. We need to consider whether or not somebody who feels very vulnerable, who feels unprotected, is able to be protected.
Yeah, we want to see that light at the end of the tunnel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want to know what's in that tunnel, that I don't have anything afraid or any fear walking through that tunnel. And I think it is important that we relook at everything for each one of the tunnels through Park City and just say, hey, are we sure, not just would a law enforcement professional feel safe walking through it, but would one of our most vulnerable, would one of our kids, would one of our people who don't feel real confident, maybe they're having a hard time walking, would they feel real confident walking down this hallway?
Yeah, any follow-up that you know of then?
I haven't heard of something, but I'm sure they're looking into it. We have, of course, wonderful police department, and I've heard so many great things, and I've met so many great people in our police department who really want the best in mind for everybody who's struggling, everybody who's in need, and so I know that they're at least going to look at it and see if there's something they can do.
Okay. And how are her two children? I think they're both adults, yeah?
They are. They are. So her youngest child, our son Alex, has gone off to college down in Provo. So I was able to check on him, and he seems to be doing well, starting off his school, and, you know, just focusing on the best ahead. Her daughter, who's a little bit older, early 20s, is doing well, and she just really appreciates the amount of love that's been showed by the community. So even the last time I talked to her about a week and a half ago, she expressed again how much she appreciated each person that's reached out, each person that sent something or just sent a note and wanted to help out.
Okay, so what was Christian Center able to help them with?
So we were able to help them with rent. We were able to help them with a gift. We were to help them with some pantry, some food assistance, checking to make sure they had everything they needed as far as warm clothes and items for their house. You know, a lot of the things that we get donated at the Christian Center, people think everything is sold. No, not everything is sold. A lot of our items are sold to pay for the pantry, to pay for the drivers, to be able to accomplish the thing that we do in people's lives. But a lot of the items are actually given away. That if somebody walk into any one of our four stores and just say, I'm at need, here's something that I really, really need, all of our managers are able to give things away to people and make sure that we're providing that direct point of care. And we were able to do that for them as well.
All right. So, I mean, she's on her feet then. I mean, she's able to pay rent. And,
she is.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. Let's see. In terms of some kind of year-end report for 2024, have you prepared those numbers?
We have. We have a wonderful year-end report. We're continually trying to find better ways, obviously, to help people, not just to provide a crutch. You know, a lot of things that we look at, we think, oh, this is just a crutch to provide a meal at a time that they need a meal. Our goal is to provide a stepladder. So we've been looking at every single one of our programs over the last few months and saying, how is this helping somebody to not need this service in the future? As you think about counseling, are we really preparing people not to need counseling in a few months and to feel more in control of their lives and be able to deal with some of their emotions and some of the stress and some of the anxiety and some of the pain in the relationships? As we think of food pantry, my greatest joy is when I meet somebody that says, oh, the food pantry was wonderful. And I say, was? They say, oh yeah, I needed it a lot at one point in my life, and having that helped me to get my finances in check and helped me to get out of that need. When somebody has rent assistance or, you know, needs help with basic needs, to hear that they've been able to get out of that need because the Christian Center has provided a stepladder. And even the people that we reach out to for things like Operation Hope for the Christmas gifts or back to school basics for the gift cards and the backpacks, for them to reach back and say, actually, I don't need it this year. I'm doing much better than last year. That is what success looks like to us. So it's not just the numbers, it's knowing that we are actually making a difference in somebody's life.
But it seems like those numbers do get bigger and bigger every year. Every year's helping more and more people.
They do. They do. So we had the most number of pantry visits last year than we've had in our 25-year history. And I do want to mention that. So this is our 25th year. So this whole year, you'll be seeing things from the Christian Center celebrating 25 years. We were founded in 2000, so this is our 25th year. So we're very excited about that. We have the most number of visits that I mentioned in the pantry last year. The scary thing is that has not continued over the last month and a half. And I do want to mention that a lot of our most vulnerable, most needy in our community are not coming right now to the food pantry. And talking in some other nonprofits, especially ones who focusing on the most vulnerable, a lot of people are afraid to leave their homes right now. A lot of people are afraid to go to a nonprofit, afraid to show that they're in need. And so we're working with some others. We've done mobile food pantries in the past where we can take food to them. Usually we wait until the height of the summer. We'll probably do it a lot earlier this year. Anytime we can get a break in the weather that's a little bit warmer, trying to go out and not necessarily advertising it, but at least the residents know where it is. We want to figure out a way to bring our caregiving from the Christian Center, from other nonprofits in the area, to where the people feel the most safe, which is generally going to be at their house of residence or their place of residence. So we're finding ways to do that. And it's just, it's a sad time that so many people don't feel safe to be able to say, I need help. Even if they have, you know, even if they're in need, they're not necessarily undocumented or anything, they're just unsure. They've heard too many rumors, they've heard too many people saying, oh, this could happen to you and that could happen to you. And so our goal is to bring the need or bring the help to the people and not expect the people to come to us.
So when do you think those mobile pantry drop-offs are going to start?
We're looking as early as this week. Just depending on the weather and whether or not we feel like the some of the low-income places are able to support. So we were looking as early as this week. Obviously, we don't want to say the day of the week or the location, but as people reach out to us and want to volunteer, we can help them to be plugged in as volunteers.
Okay, and how do you get that information out to those who need it?
We reach out to the managers of the low-income housing areas. So there's a number of managers of apartment buildings that are somewhat low income in Park City and Summit County and Wasatch County. We know the managers. They are wonderful, wonderful people. And so we're reaching out to them and figuring out how we can provide the best care possible.
Well, and there's also the threat of just neighbors turning in other neighbors. I mean, so how are you avoiding that?
Yeah, we're trying to be as careful as possible. You know, I know the managers are knowing, they know their people enough to say, okay, this person may not be the right person to tell, this person might be. Obviously, we have trained all of our staff members, we'll train all our volunteers before they go out on what's the legal protections, the legal rights, the right things to say, making sure that we're able to do everything we can to support and care for all those who feel vulnerable.
Okay. Do you have an annual report published? I mean, can people see that on the website?
We do. We have an annual report published, and we also send out an annual newsletter that is really well done. You can even stop into any of the stores or into the shop and get a copy of that newsletter. We have a bunch extra, and you can just take it home and peruse it at your will. You know, have it in the coffee table, let it be a conversation piece, and you can see a lot of the great things that have happened over the last year.
Okay. Anything else, Steve, you wanted to mention?
So the last thing I want to mention is the LA Fire Relief. A lot of people forget that that was just a few weeks ago that we were struggling and scared about people in LA that are struggling with wildfires. We have a huge connection in this community with Los Angeles, with a lot of the people that are hurting. And so we wanted to, even though we normally focus just locally on Wasatch and Summit County, we are doing a collection for things like new towels, new underwear, new socks, hygiene kits. And my wife and I are actually just going to load them all in a van and drive them to LA herself. Part of that is because we have a son that goes to college in LA, and we'll say hi to him and take him out to dinner. But we really just want to give those things. So that's what you'll be seeing. And that's happening over this week, and you'll see information on the website and on Facebook.
Okay. When do people need to have it into you?
We'd love to have it by Friday.
Okay. Steve? Yep. See you in a couple months. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Steve Richardson is the executive director of the Christian Center of Park City.